This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with the professor of oceanography, James Cowan at LSU. He has some thoughts about the dead zone and variants with some guests who were on this show not so long ago. We'll find out why. Also, Elaine Lalane, the widow of the fabled fitness guru Jack Lalane. Elaine Lalane will celebrate with us the 100th anniversary of the birth of the legendary Jack Lalane, who died at 96 in 2011. A novel from April Smith, A Star for Mrs. Blake. A story about Paris and World War I and World War II. We'll talk with her about her well-received novel and get an update on what's going on in state politics as well. Busy day, but now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And today is the 100th anniversary of one of the great Americans of this time or any time, Jack Lalane, Francois Henri Lalane, born on this date in San Francisco in 1914. He died a few years ago, January 23rd, 2011, at the age of 96. He was the biggest advocate for physical fitness this country has ever known. He made it his staple, and he inspired many, including yours truly, to try to live a life that somewhat was similar to his, but nobody was like Jack Lalane, who captivated millions of followers and admirers for well over a half century. And with us to talk about his legacy and his life on the 100th anniversary of his birth is his widow, Elaine Lalane. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning, Jim. My goodness, what an introduction. That was beautiful. Oh, my goodness sake.
Well, you were a somewhat younger lady than he.
Yes, I'll be... next March, I'll be 89, and I was like 11 and a half years younger than Jack. So I've only got about a year and a half before I'm 90, but I'm like a spring chicken.
Well, Jack, as we noted in many interviews with him through the years, and he was one of my favorite people to talk with, at one time, hard as it is to believe, he was a juvenile delinquent. He once attacked his brother with an axe, set his family's house on fire, and he blamed his youthful misbehavior on being fed too many high-sugar foods.
Well, that's true. He did. However, when he he set the house on fire, or he tried to anyway, he had a mastoid. I'm writing his memoirs right now. He started it in 2004, and I'm finishing it, and we should be coming out next year with his biography. Actually, he started it, and we're finishing it with a chapter from me and my children, mm-hmm. And then it's going to be quite interesting. But I wanted to get it out for his 100th birthday. It's good, but I will get it out next year. Jack 101.
Well, Jack eliminated everything made with white flour or white sugar from his diet. He ate almost nothing but fruits, vegetables, and fish for the rest of his life. He didn't have a piece of cake or candy.
No.
From 1930 to 2011.
That's right. He would not eat in between meals. He would not. He was a big disciplinarian for himself. He believed what he believed, and he never deviated. Never ever deviated. He worked out till he practically couldn't work out anymore. And that was just before he died.
21 years old, before World War II, he opens his first gym in Oakland, 1936.
That's right. Yeah.
Doctors at the time warned against working out with weights, believing it would cause a heart attack or ruin a man's sex drive or make him too muscle-bound to be flexible. But Jack proved otherwise.
Well, you really know it. The documentary was just shown at the Tribeca Film Center in New York, and I'm just coming home from it. And they had this documentary was about his life and his legacy. So that will probably be shown sometime on TV too in the near future.
Beautiful.
So he was a great believer in juicing too. He juiced from the time he was a teenager until he passed away, and now we're coming out with a new fusion Jack LaLanne juicer. So he never would take on anything that he didn't believe in. He had to believe in something. In other words, we could have been if all the people that came to us with some kind of a gimmick. He would never do anything that he didn't believe in.
Well, he believed in exercising, and the first time you met, you were not into the lifestyle that you later embraced.
No.
In fact, were you smoking a cigarette?
Oh, yes, I was eating bear claws and chocolate donuts. I was on KGO-TV, and I had him on as an interview before he became before he got on television. And when he did come to KGO, we were in the newsroom, and every morning I would walk in through by his desk while they were getting ready for a show, and I'd have my chocolate donut and my cigarette, and he'd come over and he'd say, "You know, the only thing good about the donut is the hole in the middle." And then he said, "You should be eating apples and bananas and oranges. If I didn't like it, I wouldn't tell you this." And I went, "Oh yeah," I was blown through smoke in his face. That wasn't very nice of me, but
but
I did it.
He came back for more.
Yeah, he did. And then we danced at a company party, and we danced ever since. And he had a great sense of humor, as you know, Jim. He just—I mean—he could make. I say, "I'll be there shortly." He says, "I'll be there longly." You know, things like that, you know.
Well, he converted you, didn't he?
Huh?
He converted you.
Oh, he converted me. I tell you, I changed my life. He brought over this guy from Oakland, and he had a very big corporation out in front, you know, and he took 30 pounds off of that man in 30 days. And I took a look at myself, and I said, "Oh, my gosh, the sands of time are shifting." And I was 27 years old, and I thought, "Oh, I'm going to be old when I'm old, and I don't want to be old when I'm old." So I changed my whole life. I quit smoking. I broiled everything I used to fry and changed my whole life around. So, you know, there's another tribute to Jack. The Universal has opened up their new hotel, 1,800 rooms, and they've got a 5,000-square-foot Jack LaLanne Fitness Center. And if anybody's in Orlando, Florida, they really should go by it. It's all retro. It's retro theming, and it's called Cabana Beach Resort Hotel. And they have it's geared to the families. You know, they've got rooms as low as $119 per night, and everything is retro in it, including his fitness center. And they have all modern equipment, but they've got all his memorabilia. It's like going to a museum. They got his statue there, 7-foot statue. They've got the paddleboard that he paddleboarded from Farallon Islands, 26 miles.
Well, yeah, and, let's talk about that for a moment. In 1955, when Jack LaLanne would have been 41 years old,
right,
he swam from Alcatraz to San Francisco,
right,
wearing handcuffs. Then in 1991, when he was 77 years old, he swam a mile while shackled to 70 boats carrying 70 people. And even in his 90s, he remained in good health. As you noted, he advocated juicers, and he worked out 2 hours a day religiously.
That's right. That's very true. As I say, he was a great discipline. He believed in supplementation too. He'd take his vitamins every day, and he never deviated, never ever.
Some of his quotes on this show and in other places through the years, he said, "Exercise is king, nutrition is queen. Queen, put them together, and you've got a kingdom."
That's right.
Uh huh.
Health is wealth.
The food you eat today is walking and talking tomorrow.
Right. I've heard it once, I've heard it 100 times, and it's so true.
10 seconds on the lips and a lifetime on the hips.
Right. Oh, you're bringing back lots of memories.
People don't die of old age, Elaine. They die of inactivity.
That's right.
Is it true when he passed away in 2011 that he was actually clutching barbells in his
yes.
bed?
We had a barbell and he had a barbell in his hand, and I said, "You want to shave?" And he said, and he didn't say anything because he had pneumonia, and he had, you know, but he put his mouth one way. You know how men do shave? You know, you put your mouth one way and you put your mouth the other way, and it's just he was just funny then, you know. And then I said, you know, if you don't want to stick around any longer, it's okay. And he was gone in 5 minutes.
Well, he was a man who had a very short lifespan in his family, and that's something that's a bit upsetting to me, is that he died at 96, for heaven's sakes. But if he had not lived the life he had, he might have died at 36 or 46.
Yeah,
he got another he got many more years than genetically he should have, where some people could live to be 110 or 120 if they took care of themselves the way Jackal Elaine did.
Yeah, you know, he said, you know, his sense of humor, he says, you know, I'm going to live to be 150, and I want you to stick around and find out. That's another one of his sayings.
I know, and he also said, and he said it a few months before he died on his last birthday with us, he said, I can't die, it ruined my image.
That's right.
But he did die.
Yeah, he did die. You know, we all have to go one day, you know, and so, but he wanted to stick around till he was 100, but he didn't make it.
How was the end for him?
Pardon me?
How did he go? What caught him at the end?
Pneumonia. Yeah.
Was it a sudden thing, or did
it? Well, yeah, it was pretty sudden. It came on the last, you know, 6 months or so, and it just couldn't pump up that one lung, and he just decided to go. I don't know, but anyway, it was peaceful, and it was lovely. I sang to him. I sang "If You Were the," he always used to sing to me, "If You Were the Only Girl in the World," you know, and so I sang to him, "If You Were the Only Boy in the World," to him, and so we just had a wonderful life. I mean, I laughed. He just made me laugh all the time, and if there was something that we disagreed on or anything, he'd always make a joke of it, you know, so, and keep me laughing. So it was a wonderful life.
What year did you meet? Do you recall?
I met him in I had him on the air in 19, you know, just before 1951, early. And then he started later on in 51 on the KGO TV, because in those days, you know, when television was first starting, they didn't have a lot of morning shows. And then they started to put on, most of them were in the afternoon, and then they started putting them on in the morning, and then they'd have a kids show, you know, and then Romper Room or something like that, and then they would have Jack come on around 9 o'clock, and then all the housewives would just, I mean, he just got them right away, you know. So you know, he was so dynamic, and he looks right at in the camera, and it was only one camera, and he looked in that camera, and it was, everybody thought they were just talking to them, you know.
Well, it was.
So I was 1951, mm-hmm. And then I didn't date him until 1953, so it was a couple of years.
You were with him almost 60 years.
Yeah, we were married 55. Well, we would September 24th would be our 55 wedding anniversary. But we went together 6 years before we were married. So I was with him. Yes, I was with him over 60 years. It was a great life, and it's gone by so fast. I can't believe it.
We're listening to the voice of Elaine LaLanne, the widow of the legendary Jack LaLanne, and we shall return after this brief timeout on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest for a few more minutes is Elaine LaLanne, the wife of Jack LaLanne, who died on January 23, 2011, born on this date, September 26, 1914, 100 years ago, in San Francisco, and he was an American like few others and proud of his country. And he was preaching physical fitness not because it made him and others look good. It made them feel good and live longer and have better quality of life. Why as a country have we gotten less fit rather than more fit despite his admonitions?
Well, it's television, I mean, and it's computers. You're either a couch potato or you're running down the road, you know. There seems to be no in between, and you have to be motivated, and that's what he did. He motivated people to get off their seat and onto their feet. He says Henry Ford got them on their seat and off their feet and onto their seat. I says I want to get them off their seat and onto their feet.
Well, it is interesting that I think you're right, too, by the way, that television is part of the reason why we're not fit. But Jack LaLanne, he thought television would be something that would make people more fit because they would be watching him and doing what he did on the Jack LaLanne Show, which began in 1951. It was the first workout program on the air. He performed calisthenics. I remember my mother doing them with him, He used to joke. He said, you know, your mother and I spent a lot of time on the floor together.
Right. Well, we have a lot of those shows that have not been seen on our website at jacklaLanne.com. We have my son, Dan, has gone to CBS, and he's remastered 10 volumes, and one volume has got 5 shows on it, and they're just like they're brand new now, and really what he's saying in those shows is what people are doing today, you know.
Well,
so he was way ahead of his time.
He was indeed, no doubt about it, and he used, for the most part, only a chair and a table edge. That was his workout equipment.
I have to tell you this. You know, we got a postcard one time, years ago, and this lady wrote this little postcard. She says, Jack, I've been watching your show for 10 years, and that chair hasn't lost a pound.
Well, he didn't have a piece of cake from 1930 until his death 81 years later.
That's right.
Talk about discipline. And he did say, and he was an advocate of having alcohol in moderation. He would have a glass of wine every now and then.
Oh, yes. He said, you wouldn't eat 100 apples a day, would you? You know? And so if you do everything in moderation, you can't go wrong.
But
go
ahead.
He never saw anybody that was heavy or fat. He said, I can always see them as they can be, you know? He could see people like, and if you're skinny, I can build you up. If you're heavy, I can take it, and I can take it off, you know. And he never tried to change anybody. He said that we can't change them. We can only motivate them, you know. And people will go the opposite way. If you should be doing this and you should be doing that. Well, that's the first thing that they go the opposite way, you know. So he tried to be an example himself.
Now, in one of our discussions through the years, he had just had a car accident, and he was quite frustrated. Here's a man who spent his whole life trying to stay in shape, and he gets
hit head on
and gets seriously injured and ends up having both knees replaced, right?
Right, uh-huh.
And he was not a young man when this happened.
No, he was in his 70s.
And yet he came back like a champ.
Yep. Yep, he did, yeah. He just took life as it came. You know, you have to take life as it comes. You have to take the bitter and the bitter with the sweet. And if you have something wrong with you, work around it, he said. If you got an injury, work around that injury. If you got a bad back, you can lift your arms. You know, you can do something. But a lot of people will say, well, I've got this bad foot or in this leg. And then they just don't do anything. So it's trying to work around it.
I bet you miss him.
I miss him. I you know, writing this book that we're writing, and I've got 14 chapters finished, and the kids are all writing their chapters, and I'm reliving our life. it's beautiful, and I've got in my office. We've got pictures all of them all. So I just feel he's all around all the time, you know.
Well, he was in a few movies.
Yep.
Usually playing himself.
That's right. He always played himself.
Starting with The Ladies' Man in 1961.
Right.
And he is part of the fabric of American life, and he was with television in its onset and was one of the first big television stars in this country. His career spanned six decades. He was a presence that did not go away, and he made sure that he remained relevant right up to the end of his life and remains so today.
Yep. He wasn't just a flash in the pan, whatever.
No doubt.
Whatever that expression is.
He called you Lala.
Yep. You know, it all started when he was introducing, somebody was introducing me to their friend, and they got all confused. They said, "This is Elaine, Elaine. I mean, Lalaine, Lalaine." And Jack came up with, "Oh, just call her Lala." And so from then on, everybody's been calling me Lala. And, you know, with his sense of humor, he'd say, "Lala, Lalaine." Oh, my goodness. He says, "That sounds like a stripper."
He once commented that he would go out in public sometimes, and you know, some jerk would want to take him on. How did he respond to that?
He'd have him end up laughing. You know, he'd make some kind of a joke, and when people make fun of him, he'd always make a joke of it. You know, when he was first started in business, people made fun of him all the time, you know, call him a muscle man, and let me see you comb your hair, Jack. You know, you're all bound up with your muscles, you know.
Have you kept all his equipment, his gym? Is it
still? Oh, yeah, I've got all his equipment. And as I say, a lot of stuff has been cloned down there in the Cabana Beach Resort Hotel in Orlando and at the fitness center. And then several museums have some of his things, and he's going to be, I hope his legacy will continue to be on, because he was an inspiration.
That he was. Well, we thank
you. He invented the first, you know, leg extension machine and what they call the Spitz machine now. That was his idea. He didn't know in 1936, in the early 30s, about patents and things like that, you know. So a lot of his ideas just went on, and people just improved upon them and did their own patents, you know, like Rudy Smith. And he always gave Jack the credit for it was his idea, you know. He was quite an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And a wonderful husband.
Well, thank you for sharing his story on the 100th anniversary of the birth of the great Jack Lalaine. Thank you, Elaine Lalaine.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you, everybody.
And before we switch gears here, let's get a snippet of the great Jack Lalaine, who preached fitness like nobody else.
Do you ever stop to think about the American flag and what it stands for? Representing what? The greatest nation on the face of the earth. Do you ever stop to think of what went into making this flag possible? The tremendous thought, the sacrifice, the lives lost, the toil, the fitness that went into it. When our forefathers were making this flag possible, they had this nationalistic feeling. They worked together as a team. No jealousy. Everybody was together to make America great. But now that we have too much of everything in this great land of ours, too many things are being done for us, we have become soft, mentally and physically. So this symbol here of the greatest nation in the world, first-class nation, first-rate nation, we are going to be losing our place very sudden-like as a first-class power if something isn't done radically to make the people more fit. That's why it's of all important for you and I to set examples to show people.
The great Jack Lalaine, who was born on this date 100 years ago. James Cowan is in house, professor of oceanography at Louisiana State University, the E. L. Abraham. distinguished professor in Louisiana Environmental Studies, and he is here to speak about the dead zone. We had some scientists in-house a few weeks ago who had some thoughts, and of course Dr. Cowan was listening intently. And you believe that some of the ideas conveyed are certainly in variance with your beliefs. Why so?
Well, one of the things that... One of the things that is an issue in my mind is that it's very difficult to interpret the effects of the dead zone out of context with other things that have changed the system, I think, more dramatically than the dead zone itself. A lot of the species that we harvest in Louisiana are spawned in the winter and use the estuarine nursery. And by the time the dead zone forms, most of those animals have already spawned and entered the estuary. But the other thing is that for like the very long time, the shrimp fishery in the Gulf of Mexico was overcapitalized, and there were too many shrimp boats, and there was an enormous amount of fish bycatch that were caught by the shrimpers, and there was a lot of activity done, you know, to try to...
All right. Well, how significant is the dead zone right now?
Right now, it's not terribly significant because the reduction in bycatch that's happened since 2002 because of the price of imported shrimp, the groundfish biomass in the Gulf, in the area where the dead zone is increasing exponentially. And okay. It's higher now than it's been since 1960.
We're talking about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. There are other dead zones in the world, but this one is considered by many to be the most perilous. But you're saying some of this is not as dooming as some are forecasting.
Balanced against other possible impacts and historical impacts, you know, the removal of billions of fishes from the Gulf through the shrimping was a big problem, and the area where the hypoxia forms will be trawled over and over again many times during the winter months when the brown and white shrimp fisheries move offshore. So, trawling has been shown to be a very damaging impact on the seafloor, and we maybe avoid a little bit of that because we have such soft sediment environments. But at the same time, you can't until you understand the magnitude of the removals in the shrimp trawl bycatch, it's really hard to interpret the dead zone in that context.
2975633. A few more minutes with Dr. James Cowan, LSU professor of oceanography. Now, Nancy Rabelais, who was with us, says in 2010, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico was the size of the state of New Jersey. That would be a big landmass. Is that correct?
I don't know. It's probably correct. I don't doubt that the estimates of the size of the hypoxia zone is well studied, but one of the things that I think it's to keep in mind is that it's hypoxia and not anoxia, which is a big difference because anoxia is zero oxygen, and that has a much bigger impact on the biota. The other thing is that the layer, the thickness of the hypoxic zone is relatively shallow. It's only about a meter or so off the seafloor, maybe two. The other thing is that it doesn't happen instantaneously. And fishes and crustaceans, a lot of them are mobile. So as the thing forms, they just move. And in fact, if you look right at the edge of the area where it's hypoxic, you'll see fish feeding, taking advantage of the hypoxia zone and using that edge as a feeding resource. And the feeding goes up fourfold. So with anything, there's pluses and minuses.
So is it an imminent danger or future? or none at all?
Well, I think that if we can, in fact, change the way we have water enter the Gulf through the river, and we do it in a more natural way, so that you have water coming out at a variety of small distributaries, which would be the sort of happen in the normal mm-hmm. delta cycle, that you would push that water off in much shallower bays. There will be a lot of potential for mixing because of wind drip, you know, by wind. And you could eliminate a lot of the potential, because marshes do take up nutrients. You could eliminate the nutrients to some degree if you let those waters, Mississippi River waters, interact with the wetland ecosystem before they get to the shelf.
And how would that be accomplished?
Well, right now, the one of the things that's being considered is sediment diversions from the Mississippi River, and the idea would be to operate these diversions, which essentially just take river water during mm-hmm. times of peak flood, when they're carrying a lot of sediment, and push them into the put them into the wetlands at various places. Strategic places south of New Orleans and other, and to protect the infrastructure, and by doing that you deposit these nutrients into shallower water. They have a chance to aerate because of wind mixing, and you could probably reduce the size of the hypoxia zone quite a bit. But the hypoxia zone is a natural phenomenon in most of the large rivers. If you mm-hmm. look at all the large rivers, Amazon, the Po, Nile, they all have areas where the oxygen is low. It's just part of this type of ecosystem.
Well, it's interesting that we have these learned scientists such as you and others who study this quite closely and have differing points of view. Why is that? Why do you think it is?
I think that I know what I think that how fisheries resources are impacted by the hypoxia zone. I think I also know how fishes interact with the estuarine ecosystems, from that standpoint, if I interpret the information based on what my knowledge of the system is, I don't believe hypoxia is a huge threat. We certainly can't detect its influence in landings or even the surveys that are done by NOAA Fisheries every year, where they do a big trawl survey to look at resources. And
297-5633. We'll spend a few more minutes with Dr. James Cowan, LSU professor of oceanography, back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633. A few more minutes with Dr. James Cowan, LSU professor of oceanography. We're talking about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and Dr. Cowan believes it's not as severe as some other scientists indicate. Doug on Segan. Good morning, Doug. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Yeah, I'm a little confused about what the purpose is of some of the points Dr. Cowan's raising, since it's been known for some time that, the congregation of the mobile critters along the hypoxic zone can lead to some very big harvest, because they are mobile and they get out of it. But I've heard him give talks before where he pointed out that also would mask any signal. The dockside numbers look good. It's no signal from the system that anything's wrong. So concluding that it's not a threat or that much of a threat seems a little unwarranted. The national attempt to deal with it has been a very measured attempt, and I'm concerned about the potential to undercut that, because there certainly are folks who would like to see, nothing done about it. But prudent steps to protect our fisheries and reduce the nutrient loading upstream, it's been going on for 15 years now, and I don't think anyone can make a case that has had any damaging effects to try to address it that way.
All right. Thank you, Doug.
Well, that is a good point, but at the same time, I think that one of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to interpret results against a backcloth of a much larger threat, historical threat to fisheries resources in the Gulf, and that's shrimp fishery bycatch. And now the shrimp effort is only about 20% of what it was at its peak. And the biomass of fishes in the Gulf, in the area of hypoxia, is increasing exponentially. And the other thing I would point out is that most of our important fishery species are winter spawners, are in the estuaries when the area of hypoxia forms.
Well, Dr. Cowan, we thank you for joining us. Hopefully we'll have you back again soon, and perhaps have you on with one or two of the scientists who were with us not so long ago. But appreciate your work at LSU. Take care, my friend. And we're joined in studio by Michelle Southern, Assistant News Director for the Louisiana Radio Network. Yesterday at the Capitol, it was a busy day as lawmakers heard about the squabble over the Office of Group Benefits affecting 230,000 state employees. And in the days and weeks to come, I'm sure we will visit this. This could be one of the huge issues in our state in the next several months. And come Monday, by the way, Jim Nickel will be hosting for me, and Tuesday, Robert Travis Scott will be in the host chair, and I shall return midweek. But Michelle Southern covers Louisiana politics, and before we get to something that happened with her yesterday, there was a story in the New York Times yesterday that indicates a GOP error disclosed corporate donors and the price of access to governors. One 2009 document states the benefits of a governor's board membership for a $50,000 annual contribution or a one-time donation of $100,000 offers the ability to bring particular expertise to the process while helping to support the Republican agenda. It goes on to say that Governor Bobby Jindal has been heavily involved in these meetings, that people pay big money to have access to the leaders on the Republican flank. In 2011, the GOP governors Rick Perry of Texas, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, and Bob McDonnell of Virginia gathered donors at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. and at the W Hotel for dinner, senior staff meetings, and an invitation-only breakfast. So Governor Jindal is out making friends in places like New Hampshire and Iowa, and the state is debating the Office of Group Benefits, and Michelle Southern is covering everything that happens. And yesterday, an interesting interview, and this is one we caught on tape, you and Senator J.P. Morrell. What happened?
Well, I called Senator Morrell because we're running a story today. He's commissioned a study essentially to determine the cost of how much money we spend on executing somebody in the state of Louisiana. So we ran a story on that today. And whenever I called him yesterday, we had for the interview, there was an incident that I caught. And of course, I always get his permission before I tape anybody. So I had his permission to record this.
So you're talking with this man on the phone. He's in a car, and you're talking about execution. And J.P. Morrell, his office is on Elysian Fields in New Orleans, was in his vehicle. And this is how it sounded when he was talking to Michelle.
No problem.
This actually came out as part of the discussion last year regarding the protocol for pardon me one second, I just had an accident. Let me call you right back.
Okay. Bye.
So, did he call back?
Yes, he did call
he's
back.
Okay.
He's good fine.
Good to know. But then the message here, I think, is that cell phones and cars often don't go together. So if you're calling this show, try not to do it if you're driving, please. But we're good. The senator's okay.
Yeah, he's fine. He called me back. We did the interview, ran the story on the network today.
All right. Well, good for him and good for you. Thanks, Michelle. And we're joined now by April Smith. She is a established and decorated author, and has a book that we're going to talk about, but she has a long history in the literary world, an Emmy-nominated television writer and producer, and her most recent historical fiction piece is A Star for Mrs. Blake, and that's the topic of our discussion. Good morning to you, April Smith. Can you hear me, April Smith? All right, Frank, make sure we got her. And the book is centered around the 1929 Congressional Act, which enacted legislation that authorized the Secretary of War to arrange for pilgrimages to European cemeteries by mothers and widows of members of the military and naval forces of the United States who died in the service at any time between April 5th, 1917 and July 1, 1921, and whose remains are now interred in such cemeteries. And the book proceeds from there with five women who made the odyssey to European cemeteries, and it is a star for Mrs. Blake. Fine reviews from this book, and that it is after being a bestseller in hardback, it is now in paperback. Do we have April, Frank? Okay. April, good morning to you.
Can you hear me, Jim?
I can hear you perfectly.
Good
morning. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, it is a book of historical fiction, but this is something that some of us have heard about, but I think you've told a story that needs to be told about these so-called Gold Star mothers. Tell us what happened when they embarked on their pilgrimage to France in the 1930s.
Well, this was a group of women who had never met before. The only thing that they had in common was that their sons fought and died in the same battlefields, and that's how they were organized by the War Department. So in A Star for Mrs. Blake, the characters are all from New England, and they meet in New York City. They get on a first-class ocean liner, and they take off for Paris. And in one way, it's like you took any five random women and threw them together on a boat, and you're going to have humor, you're going to have fights, you're going to have hurt feelings and all kinds of emotions going on while they're undertaking this journey that would ultimately end at the gravesite of their sons. So it's a fantastic story that I was introduced to by the diary of one of these young lieutenants who accompanied the women in the 30s.
Well, these women, the Gold Star mothers, five of them, traveled to France to say a final goodbye to their fallen sons. They were American casualties of World War I who were buried overseas. So what happens when they arrive in France?
Well, they are treated like queens. They meet with dignitaries. They wear banners across their chests that proclaim them as American Gold Star mothers. And they have they bond with the French war mothers because, of course, we were allies. And very emotional laying of wreaths in Arc de Triomphe and so forth. And after they tour Paris, they're taken to Verdun, which at the time was still a war zone, and I think they were very shocked by the devastation that they saw. It really looked like pictures of Syria. So they experienced the violence and destruction that their sons had endured. And then they went on to the cemetery in the book, it's Meuse-Argonne, where there are over 14,000 of our soldiers buried. But even then, Meuse-Argonne was under construction. And it's not the beautiful park, serene space that it is today, which is still moving, of course. But for them, you know, it was muddy paths and half-built monuments. So the whole thing was very raw.
The book is A Star for Mrs. Blake from April Smith. And Mrs. Blake is one of the five women. But let's talk about them. Katie McDonald. An Irish maid from Massachusetts. Tell us about Katie.
They all carry some kind of secret, you know, that they eventually share with the others. And Katie's is that she actually lost two boys in the war, and she carries this guilt and shame because her family was too poor to pay for both of their funerals here in the United States, so she opted to have them buried overseas. You see, the choice was given to the families whether to bring their remains back or not. And not being able to pay for funerals was one factor in their decision to leave them where they fell.
Minnie Siebert, wife of an immigrant Russian-Jewish chicken farmer.
Yes, well, That was an amazing discovery I made in the research, that there was a movement of Jews who had been had to leave Russia because of the pogroms, who came here. And in Russia, they were not allowed to own land, but here they were. And so they formed co-ops of chicken farmers selling eggs up and down the East Coast. Hmm. And Minnie is married to a very dominating man who does not want her to leave, but she defies him and goes anyway.
Bobby Olson, a wealthy Boston socialite.
Bobby is super rich. Her family owns a railroad. She can do whatever she wants, and she does, which creates problems on the tour. She lost her son, who was a doctor, when the Germans bombed his dressing station. It had a red cross on the roof, which they took not to be a sign of humanity, but a target. And she's very upbeat. She's the oldest one in the group in her 60s. She's quite a fabulous character to get to know.
Wilhelmina Russell, a former tennis star, she's in precarious mental health.
Yes, and the reason is that she doesn't really know how her son was killed, but she finds out when she goes there. And also, her husband's been cheating on her. Neither one of them can really deal with the grief. She finds, again, some closure on this trip.
And Cora Blake, a single mother.
Well, Cora's our
and a librarian from coastal Maine.
Yes, Cora's our main character because she's a person who you want to be with. She's caring for her sister who died of cholera, caring for her nieces, and she was a single mom in the 30s, in the 20s, which was pretty rare. And so she's a take-charge kind of lady, loves books, has never left the island, and is a leader. And she becomes the glue that keeps them all together.
It's a star for Mrs. Blake from April Smith. Fanny Flagg, an actress and writer of renown herself, says a beautifully written, meticulously researched slice of American history. How is it writing what is considered to be historical fiction?
You know, it's a lot of fun. I come from suspense. I've written a series of mystery thrillers featuring FBI agent Anna Gray, and so I've been in the world of law enforcement for a long time. I also produced TV show Cagney and Lacey. But historical fiction is great because you have facts to sort of build your story around. And you also have a kind of obligation to the history to tell it in the most dramatic and feelingful way, which is a great writing challenge, is to really bring you there into that time and place.
Well, April, as mentioned, was involved with Cagney and Lacey, also Lou Grant, Chicago Hope, and the author of a standalone thriller about the only woman baseball scout in the major leagues, Be the One. You have varied interests, to say the least.
You know, I go where my curiosity takes me, and I'm very lucky to be able to do that, to get into these different worlds and meet people who are part of it. You know, for Be the One, I was welcomed into the Dodger organization. It was the McNally year. It was a different time, you know, before it became corporate. And in A Star for Mrs. Blake, I've gotten to know contemporary Gold Star moms who are quite a remarkable group, too.
Well, this project, which allowed these women to go to Europe after their sons were buried there, over 6,000 women took advantage of this, didn't they, during the late 20s, early 30s?
Yes, they did. The U.S. government appropriated $5 million in 1929 to fund these pilgrimages. And it was the Depression, and it was good news from the Hoover administration that they were taking care of these moms in such a kind way. And they were. I mean, the government did a really good thing for them. I think it provided the opportunity for them to see the truth and integrate that into their process of grief.
And how did this time relate to what was to come not so long later? These women were going to France in the early 1930s, and by the end of the decade, the world had changed with Hitler enforcing his will on much of the world. How did this period connect to the next one?
Well, it set the stage for World War I, set the stage for World War II. Of course, you know, Hitler had fought in World War I, and it was all about recovering pride and revenge from the humiliation they suffered. As far as it goes for America on the home front, it's ironic, but the Gold Star Mothers pilgrimages, which were so prominent in the...
I'm sorry, we got to roll, but thank you, April, and we'll be back. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.